Hey, Kristen, how's it tracking?
With Carvana Value Tracker?
What else?
Oh, it's tracking. In fact, Value Surge Alert, trucks up 2.5%. Vans down 1.7%.
Just as predicted.
Mm-hmm.
So, we gonna...
I don't know. Could sell, could hold.
The power to always know our car's worth.
Exhilarating, isn't it?
Tracking.
Always know your car's worth with Carvana Value Tracker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Thursday, April 24th, 2025. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the new horror movie Until Dawn, and we'll present an interview with director David F. Sandberg and screenwriter Gary Dauberman. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film staff writer Bill Bria.
Hello, hello.
All right, Bill. I want to mention right at the top that we're going to try to keep this conversation spoiler-free, since most people will have a chance to see the movie starting tonight.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Before we get to the movie, you and I had the chance to see this movie together at a screening where I met you in person for the first time.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, neither of us knew the other person was going to be there, so it was like a really fun surprise. We hung out a little bit and we talked a little bit before the film started, and I learned that you're very familiar with the game that this is based on, and I've never played the game. So I was wondering if you could just start by explaining for our listeners, I guess, the gist of how the game works compared to the approach that they've taken with this movie.
Sure. Well, yeah, Until Dawn, the game was, they call it an interactive drama survival horror game, which is a lot of adjectives. I thought of it when it first came out in 2015 as an extension of what used to be called the quote unquote interactive movie game. If anyone is old enough as I am and other listeners might be to remember the days of PC gaming, I think a couple of these made their way onto consoles, but not many. It was mostly on the PC in the 90s. You had games like the Wing Commander series, which was a space combat game, but had, you know, fully fledged cutscenes in between that were filmed on a cheap set with actors like Mark Hamill and John Rhys-Davies and other people. You had the game Ripper with Christopher Walken, who played a detective looking for a future Jack the Ripper. You had Privateer 2, which was the first game that I noticed the actor Clive Owen in. So there were a lot of these that were happening in the 90s. There were others like The Seventh Guest and other things. Phantasmagoria was a horror one. And they tended to be essentially movies or, you know, like low budget movies or low budget TV shows, but with, you know, gameplay in between. And so they were very awkward in that way, but they'd obviously established the whole, like, you know, gameplay, then cutscene, then gameplay, then cutscene. But obviously, game designers are always looking to sort of mitigate the transition between the cutscene and the game and try to make it as smooth as possible. And there were obviously a lot of other games that we could mention here that we don't have time for to talk about the evolution of that within gaming. But Until Dawn was one of the high watermarks as a way of sort of streamlining that experience for the gamer or the player, which is that there's no distinguished difference between a cutscene and the actual gameplay. It's not a game that you're, you know, navigating a certain character around an environment and like picking up collectibles and doing like, you know, little third person combat battles or anything like that. So the experience of playing the game is, it's not as awkward as something like, you know, back in the old days of the 80s arcade games, like Dragon's Lair or Space Ace, you know, where those were literal cartoons that like you just had to press a certain button at the right time to interact with it. And it didn't really feel like you were controlling much. You just sort of had to be lucky with your timing. Until Dawn is, I guess, a superior version of that, where you are given prompts, you know, throughout to make certain choices, to say certain things, to go certain areas or not go certain areas, that sort of thing. And all of it visually just, you know, it has like this third person perspective that you can explore the environment with, but it even those parts of the game still look and feel like when you enter a cutscene or, you know, whatever. You know, so it has a very unified aesthetic in that way. Mm-hmm. And really the appeal of Until Dawn, the game, was that there was, and we'll talk about this, I guess, a little bit when we get into the movie, but there was an aspect to it, not as much as the movie has, but a little bit of like, there's a couple different threats or, you know, potential threats in the game. It's not just one slasher guy or one monster creature or whatever. There's a couple. It's not many, but a couple. And that combined with the fact that like you can play as multiple characters throughout the game, and it's not necessarily your choice, but like you'll have a different perspective based on what scene you're in, sort of, so to speak. And And that, you know, all together kind of gives you the idea, or gives the player the option to feel like, oh, if I were in this situation, if I were stuck in a horror movie, as these characters seem to be, like, could I survive? Like, what could I do? Because there isn't a single exact way to beat the game. There's multiple endings with multiple characters. Famously, the ending of the game, you can have no survivors, or you can have them all survive, or anything in between. So there's a lot of permutations in that way. And so it does feel in a way that, you know, games like Mass Effect or BioShock 2 in an RPG sort of way, this feels like there's a customization to the player's experience of, like, you know, this is how it would play out if I were really stuck in the situation, because I made the choice to go left instead of right, or I made the choice to explore this thing instead of stay back home or whatever, you know? So,
Okay. So yeah, that's really interesting, because the movie makes the choice to turn it into effectively a time loop kind of concept, which we've seen a bunch of times before, but in a horror framework, I thought that was pretty interesting. Like, it had the potential to be a really interesting idea. To me, most horror movies are kind of modulating audiences' expectations within a very specific box of tropes and formulas. But on paper, this one has the ability to kind of have its cake and eat it too, because it's able to play up your inherent sympathies that you have with these main characters, take you right to the edge of being worried about them dying, like you would for any protagonist in any story that you're watching. And then when most horror movies would have to have them escape from a situation so the audience could breathe a collective sigh of relief, this movie gets to kill them in interesting ways and then have them ultimately be okay and start over again. And that's kind of a cool meta idea. But I was wondering if you thought this film made the most of that idea.
I think it does within its limitations. You know, as I've talked to, I think, you, but also other people about the movie, it is, I forget the exact running time. I think it's 103 minutes or something. Yeah. So it's not extensively long. And it wants to be a wham, bam, thank you, ma'am type of horror movie. It's not looking to be quote unquote elevated in its approach to this time loop idea, to this, you know, live, die, repeat sort of idea. Even so far as, like, when you compare it to a different genre, but also a time loop movie like Edge of Tomorrow with Tom Cruise, you know, even that film delves a little bit further into the idea of, well, what would this do to this person psychologically, you know?
Right.
But how would they feel about, you know, the fact they have to keep going through this, you know? And even something like, obviously, Groundhog Day, the granddaddy of the time loop movies, you know, that goes into that character's psychology even more. When you have five characters here who are, you know, just deep enough to be horror movie protagonists, but no further, you know, you're not really getting into the nitty gritty of, like, okay, what does this mean? How is this happening? Like, who's doing this? But also, how are they doing this? And if there's a person behind it, and if there's not, like, what is happening here? There's so many, there's so much ambiguity to it. And I think ambiguity is part of the fuel of most horror, you know, because the biggest fear is the fear of the unknown. But yeah, I think that it does enough with it to be what it wants to be, which is a fun spook-a-blast haunted house type of movie, as opposed to, like, where it could have gone into a deeper realm of, like, you know, the existentialism of it, the you know, there's a little bit that they do with it in terms of the effect that it'll have on the body, you know, where it's like they still died, so, you know, they can still have, like, residual effects of those deaths in them physically, you know. So there's there's little hints and things there, but it doesn't. So I think it makes the most of what it does within its limitations, but in terms of the richness of the idea, yeah, there's so much you could do with it.
Yeah. I was ultimately a little disappointed by this movie because I felt like the core group of characters, I thought they were pretty bland, and I think it's fair to say that's not unusual in this genre, but oftentimes the filmmaking is able to transcend that limitation, and in this case, I just didn't think that happened. I didn't find the movie to be particularly scary, or the execution of the set pieces to be exceptionally effective or original or transcendent enough to really make it stand out or be super memorable for me beyond one big kill that caused our theater full of critics to vocally react to the screen, which admittedly was really great and very awesome. And definitely, I think, this movie's high point. But I was wondering what you thought about, like, this as a scary movie. Like, I know you're a big horror guy. I'm guessing this didn't really scare you, but what did you think of it in terms of, like, it being effective as, like, a Friday night, let's get some friends together and go out and see this kind of thing?
Yeah, again, as I said earlier, the biggest fear to me, and I think most people agree, is the fear of the unknown. And anything that allows my imagination to start working overtime tends to be something that I'll go for. You know, it's one of the reasons I love Oz Perkins's work, and especially Long Legs, because that movie has a lot of rope to hang yourself with in terms of what does this mean? What's happening here? What could this implication mean? So on and so forth. And so that's why I do find myself affected a lot by what most people would consider, you know, standard horror movies or you know, B movie, you know, or genre movies, that sort of thing, that don't, you know, cross their T's and dot their I's, because my imagination is working overtime as like, well, how is this happening? And what could this mean? What I'm trying to say is usually it's the faults of the filmmaking that for whatever reason strike me to start my engine running, you know, sort of thing. And so, and then, you know, I try to separate myself from, you know, when I critique these things from like, is that actually effective or is that just their fault? And I'm, you know, filling in the blanks too much sort of thing. And I definitely agree with you that the characters here are very surface level. I do think that's partially intentional. I don't think they really are that interested in, you know, developing them beyond a certain point. They do make, you know, motions here and there to give a couple of the characters a little bit of an arc or a little bit of a backstory. And it's just there to be functional, really. I don't really think that anyone's going to come away from this thinking, oh, wow, that character just really, I so related to that. You know, no, they're not right yet. And I think the intention is to keep it as experiential as possible so that you, the viewer, can feel like you're interacting with the movie in the same way that you're interacting with the game, in the way that's like, okay, if I were one of these people, here's what I would do, or here's what I would think about, or here's what I would try, or here's what I would be dealing with in my own internal, you know, thought process, whatever. And of course, there's limitations to that too, because they can't appeal to every single person that's going to watch this movie. But, you know, they're trying to leave space for that, I feel. And I think that, yeah, a lot of the variety of the movie in terms of the beasties, the horror creatures, the concepts, that sort of thing, it did spark my imagination enough to be a little creeped out. Yeah, you're right. I wouldn't call this a super scary movie for myself, but was it fun in a haunted house way of like, I don't know what's going to come around the next corner? Absolutely, for me. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. You mentioned, you kind of alluded to something there that I wanted to pick up on, which is there's a moment in the trailer where the characters are outside and there's this big storm happening and lightning flashes and they look up and see a giant obscured in the storm. Yeah. And that was like the most tantalizing moment in the movie to me. And that's kind of it. Like, you never really see the characters that really interact with that creature or anything, because the movie is not interested in ballooning itself up into this giant fantasy film where things like that really factor into the story. It's more interested in kind of staying, well, grounded is a weird word to use when you're talking about it, like a time loop thriller with, you know, killer mass killers and all that kind of stuff in this. But yeah, you know what I mean? Like more grounded than gigantic creatures stomping around outside, I guess, for the most part. But I was wondering, is that just like a nod to something that happens in the game? Is there a gigantic monster?
No,
like that
not that I recall. Game? No, I think I would definitely remember that if I had come across it in the game. And as I've said before, this is a game that I platinum trophied, which for PlayStation players parlance is a, you know, I think Xbox, they call it achievements. You know, I forget they have the different terminology for when you finish every aspect of a game possible, you get a certain trophy on your player profile. And anyway, this is a platinum trophy in PlayStation terms. And so, yeah, I would have noticed that, I feel like. I wonder if that's their little hint to, I guess it's two things. It's one, it's like, oh, this is why they can't just run back out into the forest and go back the way they came sort of idea, right? Where it's like, oh, there's this giant thing that's going to block them or stop them. But also I wonder if it's their, you know, hey, if we do a sequel, there's more to check out. There's more to explore here. You know, we can leave that for somebody else or maybe the next person to make it, you know, sort of thing.
Yeah. And you definitely, in your interviews, which we'll get to in just a minute, you definitely touch on the concept of a sequel and kind of what they would like to see from this franchise moving forward. So we'll leave that as a little tease for people to keep on listening. Without really spoiling things, Bill, what did you think of the movie's Easter eggs or connections to the game? Because you obviously have a very good understanding of the game.
Yeah, so it's again, it's something I think I enjoy quite a bit because it, again, leaves so much rope for me and my imagination to make connections, to try and make theories. I think there's probably going to be a lot of gamers frustrated by it because they'll see the Easter eggs, they'll see the connections, but they won't get all the answers about, well, how does X, Y, Z happen? Or, you know, there's even a question you know, not to spoil it too much, there's even a question of when does this movie and the game takes place relative to each other. You know, there's a theory you could make where they are taking place in the way that they were released, you know, so Until Dawn, the game was 2015 and this is 2025, 10 years later. But there's another theory that you could make that reverses that, you know, so and once you introduce the idea of a time loop, all bets are off, of course. So, yeah, I think that there's probably going to be a lot of frustrated discourse from gamers about, you know, what these things mean. But I will say that what's nice for me is that the Easter eggs don't feel like they're there just to be Easter eggs. They do feel like they're there to try and expand the, you know, I don't think this term is warranted yet, but the cinematic universe of Until Dawn, or let's say cinematic or game universe or shared universe of Until Dawn, because, you know, I think that there's an interest on Sony's part to keep this franchise something that might be cohesive, as opposed to most franchises where, you know, the games are here, the show is here, the TV, you know, the movies are here, whatever. They're maybe thinking that this could be a shared universe between game and movie. And, you know, that's pretty intriguing. And I think these Easter eggs point to that, whatever direction that might be, even though I don't feel like we're given enough information to concretely say, oh, this is when it happens, this is what's happening, this is who's doing it, this is how they're able to do it, so on and so forth.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it was a kind of an unusual experience to not know a single thing about the game going in to see an adaptation of it, because typically, you know, even if I haven't read the Marvel comics of whatever Marvel movie I'm watching, I'll have a baseline understanding or knowledge of like what it is that I'm about to see. And this, I knew it was like a time loop horror movie, and I didn't really know that that's not what the game was. I didn't know anything about the game at all. And so I felt like in some ways I was a person who goes in to see the latest Marvel movie without having read slashfilm.com beforehand, you know what I mean? Like without having any idea of the context and any of that stuff. So I'll just say from that perspective, I was pleasantly surprised that the movie did not do that thing where it stops and does like the nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Hey, look at this, you know, this is a game thing or whatever. Like it, there may have been a few of those moments, but they did not feel annoying as a viewer, I'll say. So I definitely want to shout out the movie for that, because that's a low bar to clear, but it feels like there are a lot of movies that don't clear that bar that are based on existing material, you know?
Oh, sure. And I think they want this movie to function as a gateway to the game and then vice versa. I think they're trying to have, like you said, it's a movie that's trying to have its cake and eat it too. And not just in the way of, you know, its meta commentary on horror tropes, but also its ability to be, you know, the first experience for either a viewer and then, oh, this is a game, I should go play the game. Or the gamer who says, oh, this is a movie, I want to check out what happens. And also maybe I'll play the game again afterwards, you know, sort of thing. So they're really thinking about that, I think.
So the last question I have that I wrote down here is there's another moment in the trailer. So again, this is not really a big spoiler, where you see a character is filming his colleagues. So the film is able to switch to a found footage style for a minute. And I thought that was a kind of neat way to achieve multiple styles within the same movie. So what did you think about that aspect of it?
Oh, I thought it was great. Yeah, this is a movie that, again, it could have gone the way of, you know, a too precious nostalgia bait movie in the way that, and I love these movies. You know, they're some of my favorite, you know, schlocks, but Anthony Hitchcock's Waxwork duology, I don't know if you've seen those, but they're from
the 80s,
early 90s. Yeah. And the gimmick of that movie, or both movies, is that there's this magic technology that allows the bearer or, you know, the beholder to walk into a different realm. In the first movie, it's literally a waxworks with different, you know, dioramas. And if you walk into the werewolf one, you're in a werewolf movie. If you walk into the vampire one, you're in a vampire movie, so on and so forth. So this could have gone that way, you know, where each iteration that the characters have to suffer through, you know, it's like now, you know, it's in black and white and, you know, we're in the 1960s or now we're, you know, in the 1970s or now we're in an 80s slasher or something. You know, we could have gone that way. And so I feel like the found footage segment of the movie is the closest it gets to that, but in a way that still feels integral to the structure and the plot that we've already set up. So it doesn't feel like a swerve just to be like, hey, look, we know what other horror subgenres there are. Aren't we clever? But it is clever in the sense that it incorporates it in a way that feels germane to the whole thing and not just a dead stop of like, now we're going to switch styles, you know, sort of thing.
Yeah, totally. Okay, so I guess before we transition into your interview, is there anything else that you wanted to say about the movie that we didn't touch on yet?
Yeah, I think that I feel like I might be catching some heat from people online about my favor to the movie. And I will say that so far, you know, the other people that have been able to see the movie and speak on it critic-wise have been favorable too. So I have hope that this is going to be a well-received video game adaptation. I've already seen some chatter online doing my research from fans of the game who are already not very happy about the direction this movie's taken. So I just want to say that, you know, keep an open mind, and I hope that people, even if they have problems with the movie like you do, Ben, still appreciate the creative leap that these people are taking in an adaptation to do something original and different, as opposed to, well, we have the game, let's just make the game again, you know, sort of thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, so let's take a break, and then we'll come back and get into your interview with David F. Sandberg and Gary Dauberman.
These days, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make all kinds of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs in towns and cities across the country. And jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com. And get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
Okay, so real quick, before we jump into this, I don't think this is a really spoilery conversation, but maybe if you've gone this far and been tantalized enough to see the movie and you don't really want anything spoiled, maybe I'll just put this right now as like a spoiler warning just in case. So I don't recall the specifics of every single line that Bill had with these folks, but I just want to put this here and don't get mad at me later. Basically, this is me covering myself. So, okay, here is Bill's conversation with director David F. Sandberg and screenwriter Gary Dauberman.
Congrats on the movie. I wanted to start by asking both of you that this movie is such a loving ode to horror movies, and both of you have such long careers now within the genre. So I was curious, what is it about making horror that keeps you coming back for more? Was there something you were trying to specifically do with this movie, or was it just love of the genre?
I mean, for me, it is my favorite genre. But I mean, in this movie, one of the things in particular was a chance to go all out with like practical effects and you know, monsters and all these things that I've been wanting to do forever. Because even in like the previous horror movies I've done, they've been sort of supernatural and kind of like not as gory or, you know, not as much. So this was a real chance to like finally let all that out and get to experience all these things and try on like genres I haven't worked in before, like slasher or found footage and these things. And really, yeah, I just love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for me, it's really the love of the genre. Like, I'm never not going to be making horror movies. I mean, you know, of course work on other things, but I just love the genre so much. It's a, you know, provides me great comfort, and I've loved it my entire life. So it's just, you know, I feel very lucky I get to work within it.
Oh, I feel that too, man. Especially the comfort thing too. And Gary, you did something I really adored with Annabelle Comes Home, which is you made that movie a bit of a monster mash. And I feel like you and Blair have continued that idea with this script. What surprised me is that the creatures and the monsters in Until Dawn are reminiscent of the past, but they're not slavish to it. It's not like an easy nostalgia bait. So what was the process like for you guys whittling down the types of threats and creatures and monsters that would appear in this?
I mean, a lot of it comes from a story standpoint. You know, we knew, psycho slasher, it feels very ground. You know, it's a very grounded thing, and the movie starts out in a very grounded way. So we wanted to keep that through the first act. And then, you know, quite honestly, just, you know, you just have creative discussions of like, okay, now we're in the supernatural portion of the act. We need to get some exposition out. You know, I mean, there's, you know, maybe she gets possessed and she can start, you know, so you just start spitballing ideas and realize like what genre is going to help lend itself to pushing the story forward as well. And that's kind of how you determine which, you know, how the genres sort of lay out sequentially, you know what I mean? And then, of course, the body horror, it's like now they're in the bathroom and they're just waiting it out. And it's tough, like, what can you do when they're just sitting in a bathroom and they're waiting it out? And you go, oh, maybe they...
Yeah, you have to show them that you can't just sit around and wait.
Yeah, so then you start thinking of creative ways to kill them that way.
Oh, cool.
So, you know, so it's, you know, the story helps dictate dictates those choices.
Of course, of course. David, I watched your Using Cuts as a Visual Effect video, which I love so much.
Right.
And I know that it feels like horror filmmakers unanimously have sung the praises of practical effects ever since CGI, you know, made its foray into the industry. But it feels like that most of those discussions tend to revolve around prosthetic makeups or, you know, gore gags, that sort of thing. Whereas your video really pointed towards the whole magic trickery of, you know, filmmaking and really just, you know, how you can hide it in cuts and how you can do these things on set or in camera, so to speak. When you were developing the practical effects for this film, was it difficult to sell your collaborators on, you know, doing these techniques when they, you know, might come back at you with like, hey, we can just erase that wire with, you know, Photoshop or something in post?
Well, we do erase a lot of wires.
Well, sure.
So there is visual effects in the movie for sure. Taking off tattoos and things like that that we couldn't cover up. But no, I mean, I think everyone was on board with it. I mean, I know there were some things where in pre-production going through, especially when we're talking to the VFX vendor and with the people here at Sony, it was like, well, of course, this is going to be visual effects. And you had to go like, no, we can do it this way. And like, well, this is going to be a visual effect because it always is. And it's like, no, I think we can actually do it this way. And so, I mean, the approach was to try and take practical as far as possible. And then we still had VFX in our toolbox if needed, but it was always, it is something very satisfying and very fun when you can come up with those like almost like magic tricks and ways of doing it in camera and save the VFX for like, yeah, the wires and the boom shadows and things like that.
Absolutely. Because of all this variety involved, I love that you guys have that sequence in, you know, somewhere in the third act of, you know, they look at the character's phone and all those videos are on it. Were you cheeky and did you use that moment to hide a lot of deleted material, or was that always arranged that way to be that sort of montage-y sort of thing?
It was always arranged that way, but it was interesting because they didn't tie into anything. You know, we had to prioritize the main scenes. Mm-hmm. So when it came to doing them, it was sort of kind of like, okay, well, we have these three actors today. You know, we never had all of them for one of those. So we kind of have to do like, okay, well, we can hear Abe's voice off camera and we can sort of come up with like, okay, what kind of body parts do we have over in the makeup trailer? Well, yeah, throw those on the floor there. So that... those were sort of a little more improvised than the rest of the movie, and which was really fun. And there's like a Wendigo that gets stabbed in one of them. That was actually supposed to happen in a different scene in the movie, but we ran out of time when we were shooting that scene. Mm-hmm. But we still had the dummy that we could rig with blood. So we were like, well, let's put it in the found footage stuff. So that was sort of where we could use things we hadn't had time to do or, you know, improvise a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, I love that. That's so fun. I would love for you guys to talk a little bit about the production design, because it's something I really vibed with working with Jennifer Spence, but how you guys settled on particularly, you know, the time period, like the Welcome Center and the look of it, the aesthetic, when, you know, you have a palette here that because of the script, it could have been potentially so wide open.
Yeah, I mean, Jennifer Spence is awesome. I've worked on her with her on most of my movies now. And also the team in Budapest. I mean, we got so much value out of filming in Budapest because not only are they great at building sets, like building the Welcome Center and the gas station, Witch's House, but we also had actual locations to shoot in, like the tunnels underneath Budapest. I mean, those are real. So it's like you get so much production value sort of for free. And to me, it's so important for a movie because it adds, especially to a horror movie, because it adds to the creepiness of it. And the you get inspiration for scares and things like that. So it's you know, one of the best tools. And often when people talk about films where they say like, oh, that movie has great cinematography, like it looks so great. It's often the production design that people sort of almost like mistake for cinematography, because it's just like, well, it's the production design that makes it looks that good.
Yeah, it looks just so appealingly gross to me. Gary, this movie has, you know, a little bit of timelessness, and what I was saying earlier about the fact that there's all these, you know, multiple subgenres of horror that are fed into it. But it also feels really now to me, in the sense that there's this been this recent wave of meta horror, you know, like the Happy Death Days and that sort of thing, and obviously video game films. And this, of course, takes that literal video game structure of you die and then you try again, you know, Edge of Tomorrow. Yeah. Like, there's almost this like maximalist existentialism to the script. How did you manage to keep a handle on that? Because it is such a potentially big idea that, you know, these characters are not constantly freaking out, like, I died yesterday or like 2 hours ago and now I'm alive again sort of thing. You know, how do you keep that under control?
It does, you know, it can quickly become unwieldy, especially when you have, you know, it's five characters or whatever, and it's a lot to service. But it is, it's a lot of, so, you know, your draft is pretty hefty at the, you know, the first couple ones. And then it's about paring it down, and it's more, you know, it becomes just, you know, more editorial choices and stuff. But it's, the movie feels so big for what it is, but it could have snowballed into something that, yeah, you can't get your arms around, which I think it would, you know, the movie would suffer because of it. So I think David does a great job of keeping those plates spinning without them all just, you know, crashing to the ground. So yeah, it's a tough, That was probably one of the more challenging aspects of the writing process.
Well, it's a threaded needle, and I really appreciated how it pulls off.
Thanks.
So I guess I should ask you guys individually. I know you've probably been asked this, but what your personal favorite kill is. But I'll add the caveat: is it because of how it came off, or was it because of the process getting to it?
I mean that we might have the same answer. But the bathroom sequence, it was just so satisfying because it worked out so well. And it was something I looked forward to right from reading the script. And it was the last thing we shot, so it was a long time coming. But it turned out exactly the way I wanted to, which is rare when you're making movies.
Yeah, the one thing I'll add is it's certainly not a kill on screen, but it's the start of a kill that has just stuck with me, and it's in the found footage sequence, and there's a mask at the end of the hall, and then it pops forward and becomes this giant man in the hallway, and it's just really that's all David, literally, because that's him, but also, you know, he had pitched that to me, and I don't know where you came up with that, but I remember him pitching something similarly to me for Annabelle Creation. Not a similar scare, but like in a similar fashion, he pitches me a scare for Annabelle Creation. It's a moment in the barn.
Oh yeah.
And it's always my favorite thing when he pitches something to me, because I always know it's going to be, I'm like, oh, that, I can't wait to see that, because it's not in my head, it's in his, so I get to just experience it as like, you know, so as a fan of his stuff and not really knowing what he's going to do with it. I mean, I'm writing it, but I'm writing it very much like, nah, David's doing something with a mask, you know, or whatever. So it's very broad. So, and then he just does it. It feels very exciting, because I get to, during dailies, I watch it like the first time. I'm like, oh, this is so cool.
Yeah.
And you really get that on when you've written something, you kind of know what's going to happen. And on this one, I was like, I'm going to save this and see what it looks like.
Yeah.
And it's awesome.
Oh, that's so great. And that brings me to think of David. I've loved your sense of timing as a filmmaker ever since Lights Out. And I was curious to know, for this, when you're working with your editor or editors, I don't see if it's multiple, but what was the process like? Because there is so much material and obviously a lot of tonal changes and, you know, that sort of thing. Was it a relatively smooth process for you guys in post, or was it something that you had to really, you know, whittle down?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a bit of a process to try different things, you know, work with Michelle Aller is the editor I've worked with on all my movies now. It's interesting because first you come in and like she's done the first cut of everything, like just because she's cutting while we're shooting. And it's sort of interesting to see like, oh, you did it this way, and that's not what I imagined. And then you know, it's a process to sort of that you go over a bunch of times, and then, you know, showing Gary and getting his thoughts on things, and you just keep doing that, including doing the test screenings and things, which can be the most valuable, because then you sit there with an audience and you hear the reactions and you immediately feel and know like what's working, what's not. So it's a, you know, it's a process of testing different things. And I mean, you have a clear idea to start with, but sometimes it needs tweaking.
Yeah, Dana's such a deliberate filmmaker that there's not a lot of fine. I mean, like, you know what you want. Where there's some filmmakers that'll just shooting everything because I don't know what this is yet. So I'm going to find any edit, which can be a nightmare. But he's so deliberate with what he shoots that, like, you locked in on a cut pretty early. That's not not remarkably all that different from you know. I mean, yes, it's compressed and it's, you know, you get it tighter. It lays out similarly.
It's mostly just getting things tighter.
Yeah,
you know,
which is great.
Yeah, it's awesome. So I won't get into specifics for fear of spoilers, but I'm a huge fan of the game, as I said before. It was one of the few that I platinum trophied. So I did every ending, you know, because I had to see.
Yeah.
I used a guide, so, you know, I'm not that good. And, you know, the ending to this movie promises some intriguing connections, but leaving those aside, there's obviously a great deal of potential here to explore more within this universe. Do you guys think a sequel is a possibility, that sort of thing?
Well, it's certainly possible, because you could do so much more with it. Like, and you could even do it with a new cast of characters in a different location. You know, like, it's open for a lot. I mean, I don't know. I'm so focused just on, like, one movie at a time, and then we'll see. You just want to do the best version of whatever you're doing at the time. But you certainly could, because there's a lot you could do with it.
Yeah, but I'm hoping that there's a new game that's part of the story. Like my ideal scenario is that there's a game, a movie or a TV, you know, whatever it is, but just really building it out in all different kinds of media, I think is what's exciting. So it's not just, it's the game franchise over here, it's the movie franchise over here. I really like the idea of it being just one interconnected franchise.
Well, that's awesome, and that's so exciting to me. One of the things I love about it. So thank you guys again for talking to me today.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and congrats on the movie.
Thanks, man.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
All right, that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about Until Dawn at slashfilm.com. I will try to link to a couple things in the show notes. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.